Welcome to the Ankletopia podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss British travel, history, and culture. This week, our guest is Mike Harling. Mike is an American expat who has lived in southern England for over 20 years. Now, if that name sounds familiar to long-term Ankletopia readers, that's because once upon a time, Mike used to write a column for Ankletopia called Dispatches from the South, way back in the year of our Lord, 2009, back when Ankletopia was still a young little publication. During his stint on Ankletopia, Mike shared his amusing insights on life in England as an American married to a British woman. He has also written several fantastic books about life in Britain, the Postcards from Across the Pond series, and still actively blogs about life in Britain. All links for all of this will be in the show notes because you'll want to check it out. Mike and I recently got back in touch and thought it would be fun to catch up about his life in Britain, and he's definitely still living there. Welcome, Mike.
Well, thank you.
Now, give Ankletopians a little backstory. You mentioned you moved to the UK through no fault of your own to marry someone you hardly knew. Can you tell us that story and what led to such a dramatic life change over 20 years?
Well, I'll give you the short version. You mentioned the two books I wrote, Postcards from Across the Pond and More Postcards from Across the Pond. In 2012, I actually published another one called Postcards from Ireland. And that was actually at the request of a lot of the fans I had. I had a lot of web blog fans back then, and they said, how'd you get there? So I went back and took my diaries, and I transcribed them, and I beefed them up a bit, and published Postcards from Ireland. And that'll tell this whole story. I'll give it to you in the succinct version, but that will tell this whole story in a book form. And it, to me, it's unique because it's actually a love story written in real time, because it was just my journal that I brought on travels. And as the journal goes on and what I'm doing and where I'm going and who I'm talking to, this relationship develops with this young woman. And here I am. You know? That's basically what happened. I went to Ireland. And again, the story behind that is way long and twisted, but I wound up in Ireland. And I wound up with a hiking group for a week. I was there for 2 weeks. So went off on my own for a bit, visited Limerick, and then caught up with this hiking group at Shannon Airport. And we went hiking for a week. And on the Wednesday, I met everybody, and I met Shona, who was the gal that I finally married. We started talking on Wednesday, and we just kept talking. And then on the Thursday, we had a free day. We spent it together. Friday, my knee was hurting. I didn't want to go on the hike, so she didn't go on her hike, and we went off, did our own thing together. And Saturday, she was leaving and going back to England. And I was thinking, okay, well, here I am. I'm single, and I'm, you know, had a nice holiday romance. I'm going back to the States. It was lovely. But at the airport, I heard myself asking her if she wanted to be my girlfriend, and she gave me her ring. I gave her mine, and we promised to be a couple. And she went off on a plane, and I got in my car and banged my head on the steering wheel, said, you moron, what, you just ruined your life. As it turned out, I went, 6 weeks later, I came over and visited her at her parents' house. And, the Friday we met after she got out of work, it was like, you know, we haven't seen each other for 6 weeks. We were together 3 days, but we picked up where we left off. It was just fine. We spent Saturday together out in Brighton, and Sunday morning we said, we might as well get married. I'll move over here. We'll marry you. And that was that. And just like that. Yeah. So I wrote a blog about it not long ago, because I had written a blog, because I write blogs about everything. And I actually wrote one about swearing, because I swear an awful lot. I hope you got that swear button somewhere. The very end of the blog, I wrote that, you know, a lot of the people that I hang around with now don't know that I swear, because I'm in polite company and I know enough not to do that. And then as an afterthought, I said, I imagine my wife didn't really know I swore either, because I only knew her for 5 days before we got engaged. And I looked at that, and she looked at that, and we thought, wow, we were insane to do that. But that, you know, that's how it went. You know, and as I wrote the blog and, you know, about it being 5 days, and then, you know, a couple of weeks later, so I came over in the last day of February, I came over. So we met the end of August, last day of February, I came over, first day of March, I landed here, and I've been back. You know, I've been living here ever since. And, you know, my wife is such a cautious woman, but we looked back on that time and it was just every once in a while, you know, the universe throws you a curveball, and if you catch it, you know, well done you. And here I am.
When you know.
It's been absolutely lovely, I have to say. And that's the other thing I thought when I caught back up with you and I looked at your blog and I read some old posts and, you know, looked back at your history and all the people who follow your blog and all the people in America who are Anglophiles and, you know, who quite rightly look at this place and go, wow, you know, I want to visit or I'd like to go live. I had no intention of ever leaving the States. I wasn't an Anglophile. I was happy where I was, and I just wound up living here. And I have to tell you, it's pretty darn nice. You know, for all you Anglophiles out there that want to come over, it's really nice.
I can concur.
Not to rub it in.
You're Anglophile by accident.
Yeah. Well, and that's also part of the story. I don't know if that's which one of the books, but I do remember writing about this. I was living in a place in Clifton Park, New York, and I could go out on my balcony and I could see where I went shopping for the week. And it was within easy walking distance, but I couldn't walk there. I had to take the car, go out on a 4-lane highway and turn at the red light and go down and turn into the car park, the parking lot for the store. And that really annoyed me. And I hadn't been anywhere. This was months before I left the States. I hadn't been anywhere. I hadn't thought about moving out of this. I was living in suburbia and this is how it was, but it annoyed me because, you know, it just didn't seem right. And so when I did go over to visit Shona in the October, the first thing, because my future father-in-law met me at the train station. And we got on this train and, you know, opens up this door, you know, with a thing. You get in and he slams the door behind him. And then we're going, you know, down to her house. It was only one stop, fortunately. And then to get out, he had to lower the window, reach out and open the door and then get out while the train, you know, you can jump out. The train's still moving a little bit. You just jump out, slam the door behind you. And then we walked into town and it was lovely. And then he turns down this little narrow thing that I know they call a twitten. And I'm like, what's this? And he goes, oh, it's a pedestrian path. It's, you know, so you can walk. And that's what I said. I have to move here. This is a lovely place. Be nice if, you know, that girl I met works out, but I got to move here because it's just really nice. So yeah, I fell in love with Britain, fell in love with my wife, and I'm still here. So yeah, it is. It's just, you know, I mean, even take today. You know, I got up, sun's shining. I went into town, walked across the park. That's how I get into town. It's a lovely 15, 20 minute walk across the park, idyllic park. I went to a lovely old pub, had dinner with a friend of mine or lunch with a friend of mine, walked back across the park. Now I'm here. It's just an amazing life. And I, after 22 years, I still have to pinch myself occasionally to realize I'm here. You know, this is my real life. And it's great. It's really great.
So are you guys still in Horsham?
Yes. Yeah. We're still in. We moved three times. We, you know, got the apartment here just by accident. You know, it was the first apartment we found that we liked. But Horsham is a lovely town. It's an old market town. We have a market on Thursdays and Saturdays. And it's got this lovely park and it's got links, you know, rail links and bus links. And it's just a wonderful town. I had the good fortune in my job. Part of my job was going around to different places to install software for our clients. And I went to many places in England and Wales and in all different cities. And there's no place I would have rather lived than Horsham. It's real. It's got a nice pedestrian center. It's got this medieval town center called the Carfax. Only two in the world. One's in Oxford and one's here. Carfax, they call it. Nobody knows why. But that's where the market's held. And there's tea shops there. And it's just lovely. It's absolutely wonderful.
So after 20 years in Horsham, do you still feel like an expat or do you feel fully integrated into British life? Is it home?
No. And that was a slow process because, you know, at first I'm like, I'm not giving up the American pronunciations. I'm going to be American. But after, I mean, I feel British, but I still eat the way Americans eat, which people notice. I don't say schedule or anything like that. I say schedule. I still talk like an American. But when I go back to the States, it is noticeable that my diction and the words I use are, like I say, car park now, without any sense of irony. We get petrol in the car instead of going to a gas station. So I do pick up some of that. But yeah, the more I go back to the States and the further I'm away and the longer I'm away, it feels like a foreign land to me now, because it is. I mean, I go there where my old stomping grounds is nothing's recognizable. They have roundabouts there now in Albany.
Got them everywhere now.
It's really weird. You know, I go back and I visit because you got to. I see the grandkids, this is my home. This is where I belong.
Have you gotten British citizenship, or have you?
Oh yeah, yeah. As soon as I could. Yeah, I got a British citizenship. I voted in the elections. I have a passport. Oh, wow. I just wrote to my MP, and I got a lovely letter back from him. I take part in everything. Yeah, I'm a true Brit.
Fully paid up, right?
Yes, yes.
So, going back to your Angletopia columns, and forgive me if you don't remember, but you wrote about things like British eggshells being too hard to crack, yep, and struggling with military time.
Yep.
What seemingly simple British things still kind of trip you up after all these years?
Still the eggs in the military time. I still can't get my head around. I looked at this 1400. What's that? It must be 6 o'clock. No, it's 2 o'clock. Okay, I answer. It's just and the eggs. Still, I can't. I make a lot of scrambled eggs because you hit the egg and it doesn't work, and you hit it again and it got so they pick an eggshells out. Still, I mean, 20 years. You think I get used to it, but I still haven't. But other than that, no, everything. You know, it's all natural to me now. You know, I look the right way when I cross the street. You know, I know how to do everything. You know, so there's no surprises for me much. You know, every now and again, but not too often these days.
You've written about the peculiar British habit of not rinsing the dishes after washing them. Well, have you adopted that habit, and what other British domestic practices still baffle you?
No, I do the dishes, and that's not because of the rinsing. For some reason, in every relationship I've been in, it's always fallen to me to do the dishes, and I do it well, and I like it, and I rinse them, by golly, and that's what's going to happen. When Shona actually does some on her own, you know, for some reason, she's done baking, and she's got a lot of dishes, she doesn't rinse them, and when she's not looking, I take them and I rinse them off. But other than that, I mean, a Hoover's a Hoover, except you call it a vacuum cleaner. You know, there's nothing other really odd about Britain that, you know, domestically. This isn't a domestic thing, but it is something that people do remark on, and I found quite remarkable. I'm sitting here in my office. It's a hot summer day. My window's open. There's no screen in it. You can just open windows here. There's no bugs. I'm not getting eaten alive by mosquitoes.
That must be nice.
It is very, very nice. You can sit out in the summertime and in the evening with a drink and, you know, a book, and you're not going to get eaten alive. It's nice. And it's also nice now I got a nice cool breeze here blowing through, because it's quite hot.
Yeah, I know Britain's had a heat wave the last week. So yeah. And there's the whole, on social media, the whole air conditioning versus non-air conditioning debate is raging on social media. And all I can think is, well, I'm going to enjoy sitting in my air conditioning.
Well, we have an air conditioned car now. And nice. That is nice. Oh, yeah.
Just go sit in the car, right?
Yeah. When I did work in my office, we did have air conditioning in the office. Some stores have air conditioning. It's becoming more common because, you know, the hot days are becoming more common. When I first moved here, for the first 5 years, I did not own a short sleeve shirt. And then we had an unusually hot couple of days, and I had to go out and buy two. And then I didn't wear them again for a couple of years. But now all I wear are short sleeve shirts. I got a whole dresser full of short sleeve shirts. That's all I wear. Even in the winter, I put a short sleeve shirt and a jumper on. But in the summer and in the spring and the fall. But this is unusual. I mean, we don't always have it this hot. And it's been an unusually long time without rain. And we're a little bit worried about that. You know, as I keep telling people, it's Britain. It will rain. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'm planning to do the Hadrian's Wall walk next summer. And finally, after many years of talking about it, and I've been watching, and it's going to be this time next year. So I've been watching the weather, and I'm like, I hope it's not this hot. when I go next year. So I've been looking at the weather for Northern England, and it's like, oh, well, it's in the 70s and it's going to rain every day. So I'm like, I have that to look forward to.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I haven't been hot the last 2 years. So next year we're due to, it'll be cold and rainy when you're walking there, but that's good. Yeah, I'll give you atmosphere.
I'll bring the cold weather with me, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's atmospheric. When I saw Hadrian's Wall, it was tipping down with rain and it was cold and it was summertime. Yeah. Atmosphere. You know, that's how it is.
The coldest I've ever been in Britain was in July. I went to an outdoor concert in the rain. It was like 40 degrees, and I wouldn't have a proper coat because it was July, and I practically got hypothermia in July. It was a fun experience.
Yeah, we famously talked about the first day of summer. Sean and I went to an outdoor concert. Well, it actually wasn't. It was in a tent, but it wasn't heated, and we were sitting there in winter jackets. You know, so it does get quite cold here. And even in the summer, a normal summer will be in the low to mid 70s. If it gets to the high 70s, people start to complain. And if it hits 80, they just go nuts. And of course, it got up to 90 the other week. So you can imagine everybody went mental here.
All I can think is today it's going to be 100 here.
Yeah.
In Indiana.
And I just sit here and go, well, let's hop. It's not that bad.
Yeah. I mean, it's the humidity that it gets you, right?
Well, just a quick thing. We were in Cyprus last year at this time. And my son and his wife and their kids came over, and it was 98 degrees in Cyprus. And that to them is a heat wave. I mean, I know it's hot there, but that was very hot. And the locals were not happy about it. And they said, you know, this is really unusual. It's really hot here. My son and his wife came over, got there and go, oh, well, it's hotter where we came from. it was 104 degrees when they left. They show up, it's 98 degrees going, oh, this is cool. I better get a jacket on, you know?
Nice cool breeze, right?
And even when I live there, I mean, it gets hot a lot more, I think, than it used to. But, you know, every couple of years, we'd have a week or two of 100 and plus degrees there. I mean, you just get used to it. That was before we had air conditioning. It was back when I was a kid. You just kind of get used to it. But here, you know, everybody goes mental when it gets hot. It's funny to watch. I suppose that's what being an American over again. I just look at him and go, yeah, it's fine.
So at the risk of not getting too political here, having lived through both Brexit and COVID as an American in Britain, how did those events affect your life and sense of belonging while you've been there?
Well, in one way, you know, if you just turn the news off and don't to talk Brexit, you know, you don't really have to pay attention to it. I do, you know, I'm politically aware. I'm not, you know, a real moron about it, but you know, I read the papers and I check things, and I do, you know, have concerns about this and that. Brexit, of course, I voted to stay. Very marginal, you know, now we're leaving. You just throw all that aside. It was very, very good to me because all my money, because I worked for New York State and my Social Security, and so my retirement comes from America. And when the American and when the British pound crashed, I was making a lot more money. So, you know, that's how it went. But, you know, Brexit, yeah, you know, things got a little tight and it's still, but, you know, it comes and goes. Me and I suppose you could say both my wife and I lost our jobs because of it, because everything got so tight and the budgets wound up. I retired, I say, when I was 57. I didn't really retire. I was made redundant and I couldn't be arsed to look for a job. And that's how it went. And a couple of years later, Jonah was getting, you know, they were cutting the budgets. And she was, you know, managing one day center. And then they had her managing two and then three. And she was going crazy. And I said, just quit. And so she did. And now, you know, so I've been retired I've been retired about 12 years now. And she's been retired about 8. So yeah, it's been nice.
So you're happily pensioners, as the British say.
Yeah, as I like to say, I've been retired so long, I don't remember what it's like to have a job, but I can only imagine it must be awful.
Well, having run Angletopia for so long on my own, I'm a terrible employee, as my wife can attest, because I work for her now. So she...
Yeah. Well, that's me being a self-employed writer. As I say, I got a terrible boss and a terrible employee, you know, so...
and the pay sucks, right?
Yeah, and the pay really sucks.
So, speaking of which, looking back on your series of books, have you had any new experiences that you've been dying to write about or that you could share with us instead?
Not really. Excuse me. Like, and as I say, looking back at you know, the Anglotopia column. And at the same time, I was writing a blog with Tony about the differences between, right. She was living in the States at the time, and, you know, so she's a Brit in the States and I'm an American here. And so I had a really great time with the books. And
it was called Pond Parlays. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, Pond Parlays. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's been gone for a long time. We've stopped writing that in 2011, the same time that I stopped the Anglotopia column. And I think it was because I started running out of things to do. Plus, I stopped working in 2012. And then my life got not boring, but predictable. Because most of more postcards from across the pond it's about me traveling for work. Because every time I went on a work detail to go somewhere, I always a comedy of errors. So I filled that book up without any problem. But, you know, I don't travel for work anymore. I'm here. Like I say, we get up in the morning. You know, some days we walk down to the leisure center, not the leisure center, the leisure center. And we swim and we come back, we go into town, we have tea, and like today, my wife's volunteering at Age UK. Tomorrow, I volunteer at the local wildlife center up the road. And it's all, we walk everywhere we go. We use the car maybe twice a week, you know, if lucky. Once to go shopping and once to go to choir, I belong to two choirs. And the one that I go to, I got to bring a bunch of equipment, so I have to drive down. Otherwise, we would walk. But yeah, it's, there's just not really any more things that I can look at and go, whoa, that's very, very different from America, you know? you know, and I think that's why I really haven't, you know, done anything with the books, and I don't plan on it. And as I wrote to you when we were just emailing back and forth, I gave up being a professional expat, you know, and say, I don't really see anything different here anymore that would be of entertainment or even of any use.
You've gone native.
Yeah, basically gone native. I'm just living here and enjoying my life.
Well, that's the best anybody can hope for, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The blog, though, I say it's still going on, but it's just about things. Like I said, I wrote one a while ago about swearing, which led into one about me meeting my wife and only knowing her for a couple of days. Before that, I just write about anything that comes up if I can. And it's very sporadic, as you know. I mean, I don't publish, you know, every Thursday morning at 9 o'clock. It's like whenever I write something, I might not write something for 2 months. And then all of a sudden I'll put three up in a week. You know, it depends.
You're being very English about this. You're selling the blog short. It's one of the oldest blogs on the internet.
Yes. Yes.
So, you know, it's, so we'll put a link in the show notes. People can explore the archive and whatnot.
But I found that out by accident because, I just undertook this project because I have nothing but time on my hands. And I put an archive in it because the archive widget that WordPress gave you was really awful. So I just said, I'm going to write my own archive. So I went back and I collected all my blogs. Now, Postcards from Across the Pond is what I named my blog when I knew I was coming over here. Before that, it was an Irish dance blog because I was an Irish step dancer. And before that, it was just basically a running commentary of that. It was called postcards from suburbia or something like that, or Cracks of Time. Or so I had a couple little names for it. And before that it was a hiking blog because I did a lot of hiking. So it was 1997 it started, but it was always the same, you know, the blog. It was always me, and it continued. It just changed direction and it changed names. But you know, when I saw that, I thought that's pretty old. And I started actually doing research. And I found there's only one guy, Justin Hall, who started blogging earlier than I had and is still at it. And I cannot find anybody else besides Justin, who's been blogging a bit longer than me and myself, who have been blogging this long. And it's, you know, a personal, you know, continually updated personal blog, because you got corporate blogs that go back to the 80s and stuff. I mean, you know, but personal blogs like Justin does and myself, you'd think we'd have found better uses for our time by now, but yeah.
Well, sometimes I say the same thing, but
yeah,
it's never going to end. Shifting gears a little bit. So since the postcard series, you've actually written a series of fiction books called the Talisman series, which you originally wrote them for your grandsons to introduce them to British history. So tell us about that and that series of books and how that's gone, and the grandsons actually like him.
Yeah. Okay. That's a, like I say, I told you when it started, you could just say Talisman series, go. I'll try to be succinct about it. I had the idea as soon as my first grandson was born in 2010. And I thought, well, you know, I'd like to write a book, you know, let him know where his granddad's at and what's here. You know, so I'm thinking like history, how are we going to do this? And I, you know, was kind of casting about. I had an idea what to do, but I didn't know how to transport him back. You know, I knew he had to come here, but he also needed to go back in time. So it was kind of, you know, how are we going to do this? And my wife and I were out at a charity shop one day, and she saw these blue velvet curtains. And she said, oh, I'll make a cloak out of it. You can use that. And I thought, now I got to do a cloak thing. I, you know, what am I going to do with this? But I thought about it, and, you know, the Magic Cloak series, you know, came up, and she made a wonderful cloak out of it. And I wrote the story, which was just a very short book. There was a little tiny, oh, I got it here. Hang on a second. It was a little book like this called The Magic Cloak. And it was just very small. The point was, I was trying to work on a regular novel, and that didn't come. I just couldn't get it. So I took a month off and I wrote that. But I had been thinking about it, you know, for a while. And by this time, Charlie was born. So it's 2013, and Charlie's born, and now I got to write two of them. So I redid the thing to include them both. Wrote a story about him helping St. Leonard kill the dragon in St. Leonard Forest, which is right next door to us. And that was supposed to be that. I went back to working on the outline for the book. But it just wouldn't come together. So I don't know when I made the decision or how it came about, but I just said, okay, I'm going to write this series. And in looking back over my notes, I see by July of that year, by July of 2013, I had the whole 8-book arc written out and, you know, pretty much solid in my head. And I just started writing the books and just kept at it. I did one a year for them and gave it to them each for Christmas. I'd write the book and I would, you know, have it either published by Lulu or I'd do something. I took a course on how to make books. And the one about Shakespeare, I actually did sewed together, you know, leather books for them. And given that, the time that I wrote about the Battle of Hastings, I made a bear tapestry for them out of this long roll of paper, and I put the books on those, you know, little panels of cartoons, because they were quite young at that time. It wasn't until probably about the Crystal Palace, I think, the fourth book in the series, that they were old enough. They were quite voracious readers at an early age. So I was able to just make an actual book, publish it, you know, through Lulu, and then just, you know, ship them a copy or two. But as it went on, I realized I want to get this into a real thing, you know, not just the kids' books. And so what I was doing was writing a full novel. It took me a year to write each one. And then I would go, it took me a full year to do a couple of months writing the book, and it was a full book. I would then go through and kind of distill a children's book out of it and get that to them. And then I would just put the pile of words aside and say, I'll get back to that later. And I did that until 2020. That's when I finished. 2020, I finished The Talisman. And all 8 books were done, and they had them all. And I said, you know, that's it. You're not getting any more. They did like them, because when I had the Crystal Palace, I had a lot of trouble with it. And I didn't get it done for Christmas. And I told my son, you know, they're not getting a book this year. I'd done 4 of them so far. I hadn't heard a word from any of them about, oh, thanks for the book. Oh, we're looking forward to it. You know, I read the book. So I said, you know, they're not getting a book this year. No big deal. And he wrote back and said, oh my God, they look forward to these books. They're going to be so disappointed. You know, I'm like, well, it would have been nice to have heard something like, you know, so I continued on. 2020 rolls around, I finish. And then I spent another like 2 years rewriting all of them. And then I self-published them because I couldn't find a publisher to take them on. You got that. But that's, I didn't think I would, but I made an attempt because I thought they deserved it. But if you go to a children's or young adult, they're not children. I mean, a lot of gory stuff goes on in these books. if you go to a children's section now, young adult and young teen, there are many marvelous series, just absolutely astounding, you know. So mine can't compete with that. And the publishers knew it, and I knew it. So I just published it myself. And yeah, they're out there. Anyone can buy them if they want.
Which historical era was the most challenging to research and write about?
The White Feather. White Feather was the book that gave me the most trouble. For some reason, that's when I said the Crystal Palace gave me the most trouble as a story. The interesting thing about the White Feather, somehow I'd heard about the Zeppelin raids in, on London in World War One. And this was back in 2018 when I was first writing it. And it wasn't widely known that in World War One they had a blitz. The Zeppelins came over and dropped bombs. And these were big, huge things that were dark in the sky. They were invisible, basically. You couldn't hear them. You couldn't see them. They came over. They were too high for the airplanes to catch. You couldn't see. They would just drop bombs. Now, they didn't do much damage. They didn't kill many people. But you can imagine the terror it instilled. And it was a real crisis for the government. So I read that and I thought, well, that'd be a good thing to write a story around, because I really didn't want to drag them over to France and put them in the trenches. So I left them on the home front trying to bring down a Zeppelin. But the story itself was just everywhere. I couldn't quite piece it together. The book for them ended up like little bits here, little bits there. And I just kind of cobbled their book together with a note to myself saying, when you come back to this in 5 years' time, this is what happened here. See if you can fix it. And again, 5 years later, after slogging through the magic cloak and the Roman villa and all that, I got to the White Feather and it's like, oh God, this is a pile of words I have to make into a book. And it really was agony, but it's one of the best books. I really do like it. It's quite good. But that was the most challenging. And of course, now for some reason, everybody knows about the Zeppelin raids. It's quite common. I think one of the anniversaries of the war, they dragged out the idea that, oh yeah, there were Zeppelins over here bombing people during the war. No, but when I figured it out, nobody knew it. So
your stories start in the U.S. and move to where you live in Sussex. How much of your own immigrant experience is woven into these stories?
None, absolutely none. The stories in the, you know, the ones, the commercial ones, of course, there's a background for the boys, his mother and father. Of course, they make bear no relation to my grandsons, even. They're just the same names. I kept them to say that even they look different. They're born at different times. They have red hair. My big grandsons do not have red hair. Their mother and father are different. But where they live is where they lived, Wineskill, New York. I kept that because it's quite funny. And I do a lot of jokes with it. In that when they show up over here, they go, I live in Wineskill. And everybody's like, I've never heard of the kingdom of Wineskill. What the heck's that? You know? But yeah, them and their relationship with their parents, and then having to go to the magic cloak to transport them. And in each book, they get an artifact, you know, something that they have to bring with them. And that carries them through the story. And it's the part, you know, that's why they're there. So like with the Crystal Palace, they get glass cutters and they wind up working on the Crystal Palace. In the White Feather, they get a bullet, a machine gun bullet. The Sacred Tor, they get shields. The Isle of Avalon, they get swords. You know, they have wooden swords and wooden shields, but when they're transported back, they're made real. So that's the only thing from them. They go from American kids to now they're living in medieval England. You better get on with it. And, so my experience and theirs in the books, absolutely no relation to each other.
Well, moving on from the books, you've described yourself as terribly uninteresting, but you've lived an extraordinary life across continents. How has becoming an expat changed your perspective on both America?
Well, I think it's helped open me up, because when you're outside of a country looking in, you can see it a lot clearer. Especially if, to do an analogy about now, you know, you're sitting in the living room, you're watching TV, you got a beer and you're looking out there, everything's fine. But if people outside are looking on going, the siding's falling off, paint's peeling around the windows. It got a couple of windows broken, and in the back, your kitchen's on fire. And you go, and they call you up and go, your house is falling apart. And you go, nah, it's fine. I'm sitting here on the couch watching TV. Everything's fine. You know, so being outside looking in is a very different way of looking at something. And I think even though I'm living in Britain, I can get over that and look down and go, yeah, you know, it's pretty screwed up in places. But it's opened me up. It's made me more liberal, more accepting, more empathetic. You know, you know, it's a more egalitarian sort of place. It's everybody, there's everybody here, and you just kind of get along. And not everybody does, but, you know, I do. And in my little enclave here, we're all happy and we get on with everybody. And I think that's, you know, when, and now I get to go to visit other countries. I get to go to Germany. I get to go to Austria. I get to go to Norway. And you see other people and how they live. And that really just expands your worldview.
When you mentioned that you and your wife volunteer locally, do you still get raised eyebrows and people hear your accent like, oh, American, what are you doing here?
Yeah. Yeah. They do that a lot. And that, you know, we make a lot of fun of the special relationship, but they wouldn't do it from someone from Pakistan. They wouldn't do it from someone from Brazil, you know, but you talk to them, oh, you're from America, you know, and they're really interested, you know, oh, you know, how long you been here, blah, blah, you know? So, and I still do get that, especially working in a cafe, and I don't think about it anymore. You know, I'll be like, okay, two T's and a Schuck's bar, blah, blah, here you go. And I go, oh, you're a long way from home. And I go, oh, no, I just live a 10-minute walk down the road. I live in Orchard. Oh, you mean America? Yeah, 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 that's me. I came from America. You know, so, but yeah, it always surprises me when someone notes that I'm not from here because, you know, I am. I live here.
You've been there long enough, right?
Yeah.
You got the scarlet passport or now the blue passport.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. I still got the old one. I got to renew it. So my wife just had to renew hers. She got the blue passport back. But yeah, long Americans living here, there is an interesting thing that I don't know if I've ever noted in any of my blogs or whatever. And I don't know if you've noted. And I've actually read articles on this. It actually is a real thing. I live here and I don't pick up if someone's got an American accent. And I also don't pick up if anyone's got a British accent. We'll be out to dinner a lot. And my wife will say, those people at the next table, they're Americans. And I'll have to listen real careful because an American accent doesn't sound odd to me.
Right.
And neither does a British accent. So a British person, American person can come in a room and both talk to me and I won't have any clue that either one is American or British. They're just other people, you know? And again, it is a real thing. I forget what the syndrome is, but yeah, if you live in another country, you find it difficult to pick out your own country. Because you're so used to their accent, you don't see it as different. So, you know,
yeah,
I just thought that was an interesting thing.
I've kind of experienced the opposite of that. Yeah. I watch so much British TV and consume British media that whenever I encounter a British accent in Indiana, I don't hear it at first. And my wife goes, they're British. And I'm like, yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's just,
well, there you go. See, same kind of thing. Yeah. You're very used to it. So you don't notice it.
You just tune it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you miss most about America that you simply can't find or replicate in Britain? There's got to be something after all these years.
If you'd asked me that 10 years ago, I'd have had about 5 or 6 things. If you asked me 15 years ago, I'd have had about 10, but I don't miss anything really. There's nothing you got over there that I want. I don't go back over there in the alley and go, oh, I've got to buy this in the store. I got to get this. I really don't miss anything anymore. You know, I mean, nothing you guys got that I want. I used to write home to my friends, you know, mail me this, send me some of this. I can't get this here, blah, blah. Not anymore. And not for, you know, at least 10 years. I just don't, you know, everything's.
And with the transatlantic exchange of culture and entertainment, that we all have the same movies and TV shows now, so it's easy to experience those things. You don't really necessarily miss them. So you've written about knowing British locals as an American tourist. Now that you're on the other side, what do American visitors do that make you cringe now that you have gone native?
Just the thing, just the cliches, which are there for a reason. They're loud and they're loud and they're pushy, basically. But not all of them. Some of them are quite well-behaved.
I like to think I am.
Well, yeah, I mean, the tourists that are self-aware will go over and they'll be tourists. They realize, I'm a guest in your country. I'll behave, you know, I'll act nice. Oh, the Brits abroad, they're bad. Oh, they're terrible. Legendary how bad they are when they go on. Yeah, that was my wife closing the door. when they go on like pub crawls and stuff in other countries, they're just horrible. But yeah, you want to be a guest in a country. You want to behave. You want to follow their customs and that. The Americans over here, you generally can hear them because they do talk loud. And I'm not someone that ever talked loud. But when I've had some friends over here, they really talk loud. So yeah,
I'm a loud talker. My wife is continually telling me to lower the volume, even here. I'm like, I'm not talking that loud. What do you mean?
Yeah. It's just an American trait. And that's the,
you mentioned finding a good job and then retiring comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
How different was British work culture from what you experienced in America?
Well, extremely, but I worked for New York State Civil Service when I lived in the States. And civil service, I was a computer guy, and statewide, these were my customers, but they were also my coworkers, and I would be writing stuff for them, and we would just, and then I got into the corporate world, and it took a long time for me to understand that our customers were our adversaries, not our friends. Because I kept going to meetings and they go, oh, we got the software we contracted. Can you do this and this? And I go, oh, yeah, we can do that. Yeah, no problem. And, my boss is like, no, you can't. We sell that to them. We don't give it to them. So I had a real problem with that because I just had this, civil service mentality. So I don't know, if someone went from like a regular corporate job to a regular corporate job over here, how it would be. They'd probably have a little better time of it than I did. I was too much steeped in the civil service culture. But an office is an office, and there's some good people there. There's some real idiots. And yeah, you got a good boss, you got a bad boss, you just make do with it. And it was work. And I enjoyed the work. I really loved the travel. Because I got to go and see all different parts of the country. But, other than that, it was just, it wasn't any different work-wise. As far as how you worked, the work-life balance here it exists where it doesn't in America. When I got hired, I got 4 weeks of holiday, and then 5 weeks after I was there, like 2 or 3 years, and I had to take it. I couldn't like accrue this up. It's like, oh, I only took 2 weeks of holiday this year. Well, you're taking 3 weeks off now because you need to use your holiday. And they want you to use it. They don't want you burned out. They say, take your holiday, blah, blah. The taxes are automatically taken out. You don't have to do your taxes if you're a Brit. That just come out automatically. You never see a W-4 form or whatever. It's just a very different method of work and life balance. As an American, my tax is quite complicated.
Yeah, that's
I've written vlogs about it.
Yeah, that's outside of the scope of this conversation, but from talking to other expats, it's basically America's the only country that like taxes you on your global income. So
yeah,
wherever you are, Uncle Sam wants his cut. So
mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So if somebody asked you for advice about making a dramatic life change, like moving continents for love, what would you tell them?
Well, in the blog I wrote, I told what it was. If a friend of mine or a family member came to me and said, I just met a girl, I've known her 5 days, I'm going to go to Brazil and marry her, I would duct tape him to a chair and waterboard him until he decided not to do it. Both my wife and I look back on that and go, we were insane. You just don't do something like that, So yeah, I would definitely say, no, please don't do that. And I didn't even leave myself like a parachute. I quit my job. I sold my car, gave up my flat. I mean, I had nothing. I left America as a homeless person.
Scorched earth.
Came over here. Yeah. So yeah, I don't advise it. It worked for me. That's all I can say, but I don't advise it.
Take that from that advice what you will, Lingo 12, your listeners. So for my final question, so after almost 2 decades as an accidental expat, what would you want Americans to understand about life in Britain? And what would you want Brits to understand about Americans?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I really don't know. I mean, just about life in general, you know, we're all in this together. We got to get along. And, you know, there's life over here is no different. We don't want the different things. We don't really, you know, we're kind of the same, but, you know, we just do it differently. And I suppose we have different priorities. Like I said, we have work-life balance. You don't. I wish America would get a national health service. You're the only, not the only country, but the only big country, big economy country that does not have a national health service. You know, we do. You know, I wish Americans understood more about that, because they look at it and they go, "Ooh, that sounds like communism to me." I think Americans could do more for themselves if they got out more often. You know, we talk about the American tourists, but please get a passport, go visit France, go visit Spain, come to Britain, you know, go visit Germany, go to Egypt, wherever, you know, get out and see the world. You know, it really does expand your mind. You really need to do that. Brits don't need to do that so much because they're everywhere. They've all over the place. My relatives are in South Africa and in New Zealand and Australia and all, you know, they're all over the place. You can't keep them down.
Well, and that's a wrap on our conversation, Mike. Okay, the accidental expat who turned a leap of faith into 2 decades of wonderful writing about life between the two countries, from his early days struggling with British eggshells and military time to still struggling with it and completing his 8-book talisman series for his grandsons. Mike's journey reminds us that sometimes the most unexpected paths lead to the richest stories. If you want to dive deeper into Mike's world, check out his blog, Postcards from Across the Pond, and his books, and the complete talisman series, all available on Amazon, and we will put all the links in the show notes for you so you can check that out. Thank you for sharing your wonderfully honest and humorous perspective on expat life. And for our listeners, if you enjoyed this conversation about life as an American in Britain, please subscribe, leave us a review, and share this episode with anyone who's ever dreamed of crossing the pond, whether it's for love, adventure, or just better tea. Until next time, keep exploring the stories that connect us across cultures and continents. Thanks for listening. Hi, Jonathan here, popping back in. Before you leave this episode of the Angletopia podcast, I just wanted to let you know that since Mike and I recorded this in June, Mike got back in touch with me and expressed an interest in writing for Angletopia again. He wanted to sort of reimagine the way he wrote about Britain in a way that wasn't about differences between British and American culture, but more about his life in the English countryside as an American expat and in the adventures he has and what life is like in his small town. And I said, I would absolutely love to have you writing for us again. And so we actually published his first column a few weeks ago and we published a couple since. And so I wanted to come in and say that and when we release this episode so that you knew that he's writing for Angletopia again. It's called Letter to America. The link will be in the show notes. The way the recording happened and the timing of everything, I didn't know this was going to happen. So I wanted to come in, tell you that he started writing for Angletopia again. His columns are fantastic. So please come have a read, and the link will be in the show notes under Letter to America. Thank you.